to make such a decision and did so based on good cause, but the testimony of key people confirmed there was no such interference. In a hearing before the Senate Intelligence Committee after Comey was fired, acting FBI Director Andrew McCabe stated, "There has been no effort to impede our investigation to date." Days later, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein told Congress, "There never has been any political interference in any matter under my supervision in the United States Department of Justice." Comey himself disabused the notion that anyone had attempted to interfere in an FBI investigation when he responded this way to a general question about undue influence while testifying before Senate Judiciary Committee on May 3, 2017. "I'm talking about a situation where we were told to stop something for a political reason. That would be a very big deal. It's not happened in my experience." That was Comey's story before he was fired. After he was dismissed, he changed his tune and testified on June 8th that he understood the president to be requesting that we drop any investigation of Flynn during the February 14th Oval Office meeting. So which was the truth and which was a lie? It is likely that Comey's first account, when he was still the director, was the more accurate one. Had the president tried to obstruct the Flynn case months earlier, surely Comey would have said so when first questioned by Congress about any interference in FBI investigations. Only after he was fired, as an aggrieved or disgruntled ex-employee, did Comey have a motive to smear Trump by suggesting that the president had tried to impede the probe. But how would that even be possible? Trump fired Comey, not the entire FBI. Their investigation continued regardless of who was at the helm as director. The subject of potential obstruction was also raised in a June 2017 Senate intelligence hearing where other Trump administration officials testified. In the wake of a Washington Post report that claimed the president tried to intervene in the Russia investigation, the director of national intelligence, Dan Coats, said, "I have never felt pressure to intervene or interfere in any way with shaping intelligence in a political way or in relation to an ongoing investigation." National Security Agency Director Mike Rogers offered similar testimony. "In the 3+ years that I have been the director of the NSA, to the best of my recollection, I have never been directed to do anything I believe to be illegal," Rogers said. "I do not recall ever feeling pressured to do so." Following Comey's firing, the president sat for an interview with NBC's Lester Holt. During the questioning, Trump referred to the Russia probe. Instantly, the president's opponents seized upon the television interview as irrefutable proof of obstruction. It was not. A rigorous reading of what Trump said confirms that his intent was not to interfere with or end the Russia investigation, but to place someone who was neutral and competent in charge, given that Comey had committed multiple acts of wrongdoing in his handling of the Clinton case and had also refused to tell the public the truth that Trump was not personally under investigation. Trump emphasized that he intended to fire Comey, regardless of the recommendation by Rosenstein and Sessions, although their guidance and endorsement was influential. Trump: "And, in fact, when I decided to just do it, I said, you know, this Russia thing with Trump and Russia is a made-up story. It's an excuse by the Democrats for having lost an election that they should have won." Holt: "But are you angry with Mr. Comey because of his Russia investigation?" Trump: "I just want somebody that's competent. I am a big fan of the FBI. I love the FBI." Trump went on to explain that, "As far as I'm concerned, I want that thing to be absolutely done properly." He then suggested that an even longer investigation might be appropriate to uncover all the facts. Trump: "But I said to myself, I might even lengthen out the investigation, but I have to do the right thing for the American people. He's, Comey, the wrong man for that position." As the interview continued, Trump expressed his frustration that Comey had repeatedly told him that he was not personally under investigation, yet refused to make that information public by telling the truth. According to the president, Comey said it once at dinner and then said it twice during phone calls. Despite Comey's reluctance to be honest with the American people, Trump made it clear that he never sought to halt the investigation. Holt: "Did you ask him to drop the investigation?" Trump: "No, never." Holt: "Did anyone from the White House ask him to end the investigation?" Trump: "No, no. Why would we do that?" The president reiterated that Comey's earlier malfeasance called into question his ability to lead any significant probe, as well as the FBI itself. "I also want to have a really competent, capable director. He's not. He's a showboater," said Trump. The president insisted he did not ask that the Russia case be dropped, and to date, there is no evidence to the contrary. All of this invites the question, was there anything damaging in Comey's memos? If these government documents taken from FBI headquarters by Comey were the foundation for any claim of obstruction, what exactly did they contain? For the better part of a year, the FBI and Department of Justice guarded the memos with the utmost secrecy, refusing to release them to Congress. Finally, under threat of contempt, the documents were handed over on April 19, 2018, and immediately made available to the public. The memos were notable for what they did not contain. Although Comey was quite detailed about what occurred during his meetings with the president, not once did he claim that Trump had tried to obstruct the FBI's investigation. To the contrary, in one memo dated March 30, 2017, the president encouraged Comey to continue his investigation to determine whether anyone in his campaign collaborated with the Russians because it would be good to find that out. So where was the evidence of obstruction? If it was not found in Comey's stolen memos and was not discerned from Trump's interview with NBC, how could it ever be shown, much less proven in a court, that he harbored a corrupt or improper purpose, as the law of obstruction demands? The answer is that no such evidence existed. None. Like the fabricated argument of Trump-Russia collusion, there was no case for obstruction of justice. If Comey is the key witness in any obstruction case, then the following exchange during his Senate Intelligence Committee hearing is likely to be the best evidence that neither Trump nor anyone else attempted to impede the Russian investigation. Senator Burr, did the president at any time ask you to stop the FBI investigation into Russian involvement in the 2016 U.S. elections? Comey, not to my understanding, no. Senator Burr, did any individual working for this administration, including the Justice Department, ask you to stop the Russian investigation? Comey, no. Some have suggested that comments made by the president to visiting Russian officials in the Oval Office the day after Comey was fired might somehow serve as evidence of obstruction. They do not. The New York Times reported that when Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and Ambassador Sergei Kislyak came calling, Trump allegedly quipped, "I just fired the head of the FBI. He was a crazy, a real nut job. I faced great pressure because of Russia. That's taken off." The statement, assuming it was accurately reported, does not prove a corrupt intent to dismiss Comey for the hidden purpose of halting his investigation. More plausibly, it is evidence that Trump felt pleased and optimistic that someone else would be in charge of the case who could be objective, unbiased, and competent. In a desperate search for some other act of obstruction, the Los Angeles Times reported that a statement issued to the media by Donald Trump Jr. describing his Trump Tower meeting with a Russian lawyer during the campaign was untruthful and, therefore, it was being examined by the special counsel as evidence of obstruction. This is patently ridiculous. Let's assume the media statement did not accurately describe the full extent of the meeting. Let's assume it was a bald-faced lie. Lying to journalists is not and never has been a crime. If it were otherwise, just about every politician in Washington, D.C. would be behind bars. However, the statement describing the meeting at Trump Tower was at its core accurate. Here is the relevant part. "We primarily discussed a program about the adoption of Russian children that was active and popular with American families years ago and was since ended by the Russian government, but it was not a campaign issue at the time and there was no follow-up. I was asked to attend the meeting by an acquaintance, but was not told the name of the person I would be meeting with beforehand." Both the Russian lawyer and Trump Jr. have stated that the meeting, scheduled under false pretenses, was a conversation about Russian adoptions and little more. A subsequent statement issued by the president's son explained that the lawyer claimed to have information that individuals connected to Russia were funding the Democratic National Committee and supporting Ms. Clinton. But, Trump Jr. added, "her statements were vague, ambiguous, and made no sense. No details or supporting information was provided or even offered." Moreover, in an interview with Fox News, the Russian lawyer insisted there was no discussion whatsoever about Clinton, and she had no such damaging information about the candidate. Whether President Trump dictated the press statement or participated in its composition is of no legal consequence. Even if it was an attempt to cover up an effort to deceive the media, that is not a crime. The evidence that a revised statement was later issued, providing a more extensive and complete account of the Trump Tower meeting, proves nothing other than a desire to be more forthcoming and transparent. It is not an admission that the original press release was evasive or deceitful. There is one more argument that militates against any claim of obstruction in the firing of Comey or any other of the actions mentioned herein. It is hard to make a case for obstructing a non-crime. As a legal matter, it can be done with some jurisprudential gyrations. But from a practical and reasoned standpoint, it is difficult for a prosecutor to argue that the president intended to obstruct an inquiry that he felt confident would prove his innocence. With no evidence that he ever colluded with the Russians during the campaign, the investigation of Trump was entirely without merit. If the president knew he did nothing wrong, it makes little sense that he would try to impede a probe into no wrongdoing. It is clear that Trump felt falsely accused and wrongfully convicted in the court of public opinion. Democrats and the liberal media were relentless in banging the daily drum that Trump had engaged in all manner of illegality, despite a paucity of evidence. Beleaguered and under siege, the president implored Comey to tell the public the same truth he had been told in private, that he was not under criminal investigation. Comey, who probably thought he had the upper hand, refused to lift the black veil of suspicion. He failed to do the right thing. It is no wonder the president became exasperated with the FBI director and chose to find a replacement who could be honest, competent, and fair. Former federal prosecutor Doug Burns is convinced there were ample grounds to fire Comey, none of which amounted to obstruction of justice. Comey's announcement of a no prosecution of Hillary Clinton was totally improper, as FBI officials or agents never make such prosecutorial decisions. Similarly, Comey's factual condemnation of her was totally inappropriate. And last, his explanations of the law were both bizarre and incorrect. While the president did himself no favors in his interview with NBC's Lester Holt, legally the Comey termination was not obstruction of justice. While no legitimate case can be made against Trump for obstruction, a case can be made that Comey committed crimes. Comey's theft of government documents. For years, James Comey carefully cultivated a public portrait of himself as a grown-up Boy Scout, honest and morally straight. The truth is quite different. His actions belie the virtuous image he sought. It was all an illusion designed to mask the kind of conduct that most people find reprehensible. The record shows that he was less than honest, engaged in acts of questionable legality, and abused his power to further his ambitions. One of the more stunning moments during Comey's testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee in June 2017 occurred when he confessed that he deliberately leaked to a friend the contents of the presidential memorandums memorializing his conversations with Trump. He directed that friend, Daniel Richman of Columbia Law School, to leak the information to the New York Times with the objective that it would trigger the appointment of a special counsel to investigate the man who had just fired him. It was a devious scheme, to be sure. Comey knew the media would be more than willing to trash Trump by contorting the memo's contents and misconstruing the law to accuse the president of obstruction of justice. Journalists and pundits did not disappoint. The opening sentence in the Times story on May 16, 2017, did not recite facts derived from the memos, but drew an unsupported conclusion that President Trump asked the FBI director James Comey to shut down the federal investigation into Mr. Trump's former National Security Advisor Michael T. Flynn in an Oval Office meeting in February. Ipso facto, obstruction. The headline was nearly identical to the first line. Thus, anyone who did not read past the title of the story or the opening sentence was led to believe that Trump had probably committed a crime. Of course, this is not what happened in the February meeting, according to Comey, who testified on June 8th about his conversation with Trump, narrating the encounter from his memos. Indeed, at the congressional hearing, Comey specifically quoted Trump's vague comments about Flynn as hoping he would be cleared. That is not the same thing as asking to shut down an investigation, as the Times would have its readers believe. The Times story went on to raise the specter of obstruction, and sure enough, the next day Comey's longtime friend and ally Robert Mueller was appointed special counsel. For the fired FBI director, it was mission accomplished. His media leak achieved his desired purpose. In defense of his actions, Comey offered an explanation that was in equal parts erroneous and obtuse. He claimed that the 7 presidential memos he took with him when he was fired were his personal property. If he believed that, he is not much of a lawyer. The FBI's policy manual states quite clearly that documents or records generated during official duties are government property. The FBI employment agreement, to which Comey was bound, mandates that all information acquired by me in connection with my official duties remain the property of the United States of America. Under both the Federal Records Act and the Privacy Act, any document or record composed by government employees during the course and scope of their employment is not the property of the person who authored the document, but the property of the government. This is especially true if the material was prepared on a government-owned computer and written during the normal work hours, while the employee is on the job performing the duties of his job, as was the case with Comey's presidential memos. His discussions with the president arose directly from his position as head of the FBI. These records laws apply to classified and unclassified documents alike. Furthermore, in his testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee on June 8, 2017, Comey admitted that he wrote the memos so that they could be discussed within the FBI and the government. This is an admission that these documents were not his personal property. Records that are composed for government use are automatically government property. The fact that Comey did not want to leak the memos himself, but chose a conduit or middleman to do so covertly at his behest, is substantial proof that he knew what he was doing was wrong and illegal. By using a third party to do the dirty work, Comey was trying to circumvent the law to insulate himself from criminality. He failed. Title 18 of the USC, Section 641, makes it a felony punishable by up to 10 years in prison to give someone outside the government an unclassified but protected record without authorization. Whoever embezzles, steals, purloins, or knowingly converts to his use or the use of another, or without authority, sells, conveys, or disposes of any record of the United States or of any department of the agency thereof, shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 10 years. This is precisely what Comey appeared to have done, converting to his own use and in conveying to his friend, without authorization, his presidential memos, which were government records. Having been fired, Comey stole government records with the intent to leak them for his benefit. In an obvious act of retribution, he wanted the documents to inculpate Trump in a special counsel investigation and, he hoped, generate a criminal charge of obstruction of justice. This scheme to benefit himself and harm the president also may have violated at least 2 federal regulations, including this one identified in the Code of Federal Regulations. An employee shall not engage in a financial transaction using non-public information, nor allow the improper use of non-public information to further his own private interest or that of another, whether through advice or recommendation or by knowing unauthorized disclosure. Under the law, it does not matter that Comey was an ex-employee when he leaked the documents because he maintained custody of them when he was still employed, then took them out of the FBI building to use for his own devices. This was a direct violation of FBI regulations which state, FBI personnel must surrender all materials in their possession that contain FBI information upon FBI demand and upon separation from the FBI. Comey did not do this. He converted government property to his own use, then disseminated it to the public. Comey must have known that he was likely breaking several laws and committing felonies. As FBI director, he was legally obligated to adhere to the Bureau's standard non-disclosure contract, in which all personnel promised not to disclose the very type of records and information Comey leaked. The agreement specifically warned that employees are subject to criminal sanctions and personal liability in a civil action at law, and the disgorging of any profits arising from any unauthorized publication or disclosure. Separation upon termination did not render the contract null and void. It was a binding, enforceable, and actionable contract, regardless of job status. Under the terms, Comey agreed he could be sued and face criminal prosecution. Since his firing, Comey published a book quoting from the memos he filched. This enabled him to profit handsomely from his wrongful actions, pocketing millions of dollars. If the FBI contract were to be enforced, Comey could and should lose earnings derived therefrom. The Comey-composed memos themselves recited discussions with the president that were both privileged and contained information involving an ongoing FBI investigation into Flynn's contacts with Russia. This means Comey appeared to have broken yet another law, punishable by up to 10 years in prison. Title 18 of the USC, Section 793, makes it a crime to willfully communicate or transmit national defense information, even though it is not necessarily classified when written. While the full contents of the partially redacted memos made public so far do not deal directly with national defense matters, the overall Flynn investigation did. Comey's chicanery was laid bare in his congressional testimony when he told the Senate Intelligence Committee that he deliberately wrote some of his memos as unclassified documents. Making them classified, he told the committee, would tangle them up. In other words, he manipulated the classification system to exploit the political damage his documents might cause while concomitantly attempting to shield himself from criminal charges. But this may be a moot point if any of the seven memos Comey took with him contained classified information, regardless of how he might have labeled them, or, more aptly, mislabeled them. Under law, the content dictates classification, not the markings. Sometime in late 2017 or early 2018, the FBI advised the Senate Judiciary Committee that the majority of the memos were, in fact, classified. Chairman Charles Grassley, one of the few people who gained access to the memos, revealed that four of them were marked classified at the secret or confidential levels, a fact that was confirmed when the memos were released. Richmond told Fox News that he received four of the seven memos. This means that Comey appears to have given his friend at least one classified document. Giving classified records to an unauthorized person and or storing them in an unsecured venue constitutes several felonies, the same crimes Hillary Clinton surely committed. For example, Title 18 of the USC, Section 1924 states as follows, "Whoever, being an officer, employee of the United States, becomes possessed of documents or materials containing classified information of the United States, knowingly removes such documents or materials without authority and with the intent to retain such documents or materials at an unauthorized location, shall be fined under this title or imprisoned for not more than 5 years, or both." Comey appears to have done this. He admitted he knowingly removed presidential memos without authority from FBI headquarters, kept them in what must have been an unauthorized location, then conveyed at least four of them to his friend, Richmond. As director of the FBI, he knew that at least some of their contents were both privileged and might well be classified. It would be folly for Comey to argue that they were not classified since the FBI insists they are. If Comey deliberately mismarked them, he cannot use his own wrongful act to insulate himself from criminal prosecution. In the alternative, let's assume for the sake of argument that Comey's handling of the documents was grossly negligent instead of knowing or intentional. That would be the same crime for which Clinton should have been charged, Title 18 of the USC, Section 793F. The irony is lost on no one. Comey appears to have committed the identical felony as Clinton, and it was Comey who contorted the law to absolve her of this crime, as explained in Chapter 2. But the story of Comey's machinations does not end there. Days after the presidential memos were released to the public, it was learned that Richmond had worked for Comey at the FBI as an unpaid special government employee. Comey concealed this important information from Congress during his June 2017 testimony, later dismissing this fact as irrelevant. Moreover, Comey failed to disclose that another person, Patrick Fitzgerald, also reportedly received memos. Fitzgerald is a former U.S. attorney and special counsel who, like Richmond, is a friend of Comey. Both Richmond and Fitzgerald have since been hired by Comey as his lawyers. And so, too, has another lawyer, David Kelly, to whom Comey gave one or more memos. This means that the fired director can invoke the attorney-client privilege to try to protect some or all of their communications about the memos. The FBI was sufficiently concerned about Comey's dissemination of classified information that agents conducted a search of Richmond's office to retrieve documents and contain the leak. It is unknown whether the same spillage cleanup occurred at Fitzgerald's office and perhaps Kelly's as well. These corrective actions by the FBI suggest that classified information may well have been shared by Comey in violation of federal law. When Comey was questioned by senators in a June 2017 hearing before the Intelligence Committee, he omitted these relevant and important details in his answers about his leak of the memos. Under Title 18 of the USC, Section 1001, it is a crime to give false or misleading statements in a legislative proceeding. Concealing material facts in response to questions under oath before Congress would constitute misleading statements in violation of that statute. Congress has been investigating Comey for a series of other suspected deceptions made during testimony before various congressional committees. In one instance, he told the House Judiciary Committee, under oath, that he decided not to refer criminal prosecution of Clinton only after she was interviewed. Yet documents uncovered later indicated he made the decision well before the interview. Comey insisted that Loretta Lynch, the Attorney General, never knew of his decision to clear Clinton in advance of his public announcement. Yet text messages exchanged between Peter Sturzok and Lisa Page suggested that Lynch had been apprised in advance. Comey also testified that, while FBI director, he never authorized leaks to the media about the two presidential candidates. Yet a subsequent statement by his deputy director, Andrew McCabe, appeared to contradict Comey. Finally, the Senate Judiciary Committee sent a letter to the Justice Department's Inspector General accusing Comey of apparent material discrepancies in his testimony about the FISA warrant applications, asking whether this was a deliberate attempt to mislead. There is substantial evidence that Comey did not tell the truth on several occasions, and he may have violated numerous federal statutes governing the theft of government documents, including classified material. He may also have obstructed justice in the Hillary Clinton email case and violated the law by deceiving the FISA court in a warrant to spy on an American citizen. Days after Comey published his book and commenced his publicity tour, it was learned that the Inspector General at the Department of Justice was investigating whether Comey mishandled classified information contained in the presidential memos he gave to his friend that were then leaked to the media. If he broke the law, he should be held accountable. Former independent counsel and U.S. Attorney Joe DiGenova was blunt in his assessment of Comey. "I don't think there's any doubt that Comey committed multiple crimes. If the Justice Department wants to pursue them vigorously and fairly like they would with any other citizen, he should be indicted for his false testimony on Capitol Hill and for his obstruction of an investigation." Far from the image of an honest and honorable Boy Scout, the evidence is compelling that James Comey sought to mislead, deflect, and deceive. He also appears to have abused the powers of his office to exact punishment on the president who fired him. His plan to convert presidential memos for his own use, then leak them to the media to damage Trump, suggests a willingness to defy rules, regulations, and federal laws with impunity. Perhaps Comey felt he could get away with it because he successfully engineered the appointment of his close friend Robert Mueller as special counsel to pursue potential charges against the president. Chapter 11. The Illegitimate Appointment of Robert Mueller. The primary duty of a lawyer engaged in public prosecution is not to convict, but to see that justice is done. Canons of Professional Ethics, Canon 5, 1908. Ages ago, the legendary criminal defense attorney Clarence Darrow gazed back on his long career as a central figure inside America's courtrooms and sadly observed to a reporter, "There is no such thing as justice, in or out of court." As a young lawyer filled with idealism, I thought he was wrong. Nearly four decades later, I fear he was right. I was naive. Darrow knew through experience that all too often, prosecutors are willing to abandon their ethical duty to see that justice is done. Instead, emboldened by their powers, they become consumed by a zeal to win, sometimes at any cost. Fairness and justice are secondary to the goal of gaining a conviction. The law, Darrow concluded, has evolved into a horrible business. Exhibit A in support of Darrow's thesis is the appointment of Robert Mueller to serve as special counsel. The facts and circumstances did not warrant a special counsel. The regulations governing his selection were misused. His authority exceeded the limits intended. And Mueller himself was so stricken with conflicts of interest that he should never have accepted the position. His determination to forge ahead notwithstanding these legal obstacles demonstrates that considerations of justice were a mere nuisance, if not irrelevant. To put it as succinctly as possible, Mueller launched an investigation in search of a crime, any crime. This is backwards. Under regulations authorized by law, there must first be an identifiable crime specifically stated and accompanied by some evidence that such a crime may have been committed by someone. Mueller would then be empowered to question witnesses, examine records, and gather documents to resolve whether any charges should be brought. However, this legal requirement was not met when the special counsel was appointed. This makes his endeavor a lawless or illegitimate one. Mueller has a long track record of loyal service to our nation, and many trust him to be fair and impartial, as if that excuses an improper appointment. The team of lawyers he hand-picked to assist him is as riddled with conflicts of interest as he is. Mueller's appointment was invalid. After taking office as Attorney General, Jeff Sessions incorrectly disqualified himself from any investigation involving Russia and the 2016 campaign. He was not required to do so, as detailed in Chapter 9. However, his mistaken recusal meant that the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, became Acting Attorney General on all matters involving Sessions' disqualification. On May 17, 2017, Rosenstein decided to appoint Robert Mueller as special counsel. The authority to make an appointment is derived from federal statutory law, Title 28 of the USC, Section 515, and defined by the Code of Federal Regulations, Title 28 of the CFR, Section 600.1, which states, "The Attorney General, or in cases in which the Attorney General is recused, the Acting Attorney General, will appoint a special counsel when he or she determines that criminal investigation of a person or matter is warranted." These regulations are codified into law known as administrative laws. All government employees, regardless of rank or position, are required to follow and uphold them. This particular regulation makes specific reference to a criminal investigation. To conduct one, there must first be some evidence that a crime might have been committed to warrant the investigation. When Mueller was appointed, there was no suspected crime. Moreover, no other campaign-related statutes had any relevance to the known facts involving activities in the Trump campaign. The importance of explicitly stating a suspected crime as a necessary predicate for appointing a special counsel is reinforced by the requirement set forth in Title 28 of the CFR, Section 600.4. The special counsel will be provided with a specific factual statement of the matter to be investigated. Rosenstein's appointment order provided no such specific factual statement of a matter to be criminally investigated. Instead, the order granted Mueller broad authority to investigate matters that are not criminal at all. The FBI's probe up to that point was a counterintelligence investigation, according to Director James Comey's testimony before the House Intelligence Committee. The Bureau was looking into Russian interference in the 2016 election, a national security concern. Information was being collected. That is not the same as a criminal investigation. A strong case can be made that Mueller's appointment was defective and invalid because he was empowered to investigate something that was not authorized by the special counsel regulation. Former federal prosecutor Andrew McCarthy argued that Mueller's appointment violated the special counsel regulation because the regulation does not permit the Justice Department to appoint a special counsel in order to determine whether there is a basis for a criminal investigation. To the contrary, the basis for a criminal investigation must pre-exist the appointment. He added, "It is the criminal investigation that triggers the special counsel, not the other way around." He is correct. A close examination of the order appointing Mueller shows that the Justice Department reversed the process and did it backward. There are three parts to Rosenstein's appointment order. They are worth examining separately. The first part reads as follows. The special counsel is authorized to conduct the investigation confirmed by then-FBI Director James B. Comey in testimony before the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence on March 20, 2017, including any links and/or coordination between the Russian government and individuals associated with the campaign of President Donald Trump. Where was the stated crime? The specific factual statement was not specific in any sense of the word. It was quite broad and open-ended. It referenced Comey's testimony in which he had revealed an outstanding counterintelligence investigation, but not a criminal case. Contrary to the requirements of the special counsel regulations, Rosenstein's order called for an investigation of something that was not illegal. Assuming there ever was any evidence of links or coordination between the Russians and the Trump campaign, where in the criminal code does that rise to the level of criminal activity? It does not. Perhaps someday Congress will decide to make it a crime. Until then, it is perfectly legal. Michael B. Mukasey, former U.S. Attorney General and Chief Judge of the United States District Court for New York, pointed out this legal defect in Mueller's appointment order when he wrote a column for the Wall Street Journal. Possible Russian meddling in the 2016 election is certainly a worthy subject for a national security investigation, but links or coordination or collusion, a word that does not appear in the letter of appointment, has been used as a synonym for coordination, does not define or constitute a crime. Mukasey noted that prior investigations utilizing independent counsels such as Watergate, Iran-Contra, and Whitewater identified specific crimes and the public knew what was being investigated. The whole point of the special counsel regulation was to avoid limitless investigations by unaccountable prosecutors and to apprise the public of what potential crimes were being pursued. The public, after all, has a right to know if their tax dollars are being used or misused for an unbounded search for unidentified crimes. But with Mueller's appointment, Americans were given no idea what the special counsel was up to, because Rosenstein's assignment order violated the regulation that demanded the identity of a specific crime to be investigated. Not only was Mueller's appointment invalid for this reason, but there was no need for a special counsel at all, in the absence of some evidence of a crime. The FBI could have continued its counterintelligence probe. In an interview with the Public Broadcast Network, Mukasey elaborated, "Any links or coordination may sound sinister, but it doesn't define or suggest the existence of a crime. So what's been defined here or not defined here is something that looks very much like a fishing expedition or a safari." This brings us to the second part of Rosenstein's order that directed Mueller to investigate any matters that arose or may arise directly from the investigation. This was an even bigger blank check and completely in contravention of the special counsel regulation. Rosenstein had no authority to confer such an expansive and undefined mandate for Mueller because, again, the law demands a specific factual statement of the matter to be investigated. He is not permitted to say simply, "and look for anything else that might come up." This flaw or defect in the order also rendered Mueller's appointment invalid. He cannot exercise power that Rosenstein had no authority to grant. The third part of Rosenstein's order instructed Mueller to investigate any other matters within the scope of Title 28 of the CFR, Section 600.4A. What does that regulation state? It reads, "The jurisdiction of a special counsel shall also include the authority to investigate and prosecute federal crimes committed in the course of, and with intent to interfere with, the special counsel's investigation, such as perjury, obstruction of justice, destruction of evidence, and intimidation of witnesses." In simple language, this means that if someone tried to interfere with Mueller's investigation or lied during questioning, he or she could be prosecuted for obstruction of justice, perjury, or making a false statement. This did not grant the special counsel authority to investigate Trump for any obstruction of justice that might have happened before the special counsel was appointed. Only impeding Mueller's investigation itself is recognized by the regulation. So what was Mueller left with? Investigating any links or coordination with the Russians. But since that is not a crime in a political campaign, then Mueller was tasked with investigating a non-crime, which he is not authorized to do under the special counsel regulation. He had no legitimate assignment and no regulatory authority to do anything. Rosenstein and Mueller likely knew they were bending the law into a pretzel. When the special counsel indicted Paul Manafort on charges of tax, financial, and bank fraud crimes that had nothing to do with the Trump campaign and significantly predated his brief role as campaign manager, his lawyers filed a motion to dismiss the case by challenging Mueller's authority to prosecute based on some of the arguments stated herein. In response, the special counsel filed documents with the federal court admitting that Rosenstein's order appointing Mueller was deliberately vague. This was an astonishing confession that the acting attorney general had carefully crafted his appointment order in a way that willfully violated the special counsel regulation that required a specific statement of facts. Rosenstein had no intention of adhering to the law when he named Mueller to the post on May 17, 2017. The court documents revealed that Rosenstein issued a new, secret memorandum to Mueller, dated August 2, 2017. In it, Rosenstein seemed to concede that his original order appointing Mueller did not comply with the special counsel regulations. The May 17, 2017 order was worded categorically in order to permit its public release without confirming specific investigations involving specific individuals. Rosenstein's memo then proceeded to order Mueller to investigate allegations that Paul Manafort committed a crime or crimes by colluding with Russian government officials with respect to the Russian government's efforts to interfere with the 2016 election for President of the United States in violation of United States law. What law? Conspicuously, Rosenstein failed to cite a law or potential crime, perhaps having difficulty in finding one that had any application to collusion. Therefore, even the second secret order failed to meet the requirement of the regulation that a crime be stated. Importantly, this memo was hidden from the public and only disclosed because Mueller was forced to do so when faced with the prospect that a federal judge might dismiss the case on the grounds that Mueller's appointment was invalid and he, therefore, lacked any authority. Had it not been for Manafort's lawyers who contested the basis for the special counsel's appointment, Rosenstein's memo would still be a secret. They were misleading Americans. They made available an opaque order for public consumption, but held back a different order containing the truth. It seems apparent that Rosenstein and Mueller conspired to circumvent the special counsel regulation. In May, Rosenstein knowingly wrote a vaguely worded order when the law demanded a specific one. The two men then decided between themselves what and whom to investigate and to keep it concealed from the American public. This violated both the letter and spirit of the special counsel regulations. As written, the rules promised clarity and transparency, yet Rosenstein and Mueller worked in concert to undermine them. In so doing, they have further eroded the public's trust in the fairness and integrity of the legal process. Their questionable conduct cannot be cured by their belated effort to comply with the strict requirements of the regulation. Why? Because they engaged in still another deception. Note the date of the subsequent memo authorizing Mueller to investigate Manafort, August 2nd. However, Mueller ordered the FBI to conduct a pre-dawn raid of Manafort's home on July 26th, a full week before the issuance of Rosenstein's order. Since Mueller claimed that the August 2nd memo authorized him to pursue Manafort, this was an admission that he was not authorized at the time of the raid. Arguably, any material illegally seized would be inadmissible evidence under the well-established exclusionary rule. Another curious anomaly jumps out from Rosenstein's August 2nd memo, where he wrote that Mueller's authority to investigate Manafort was within the scope of the investigation at the time of your appointment and are within the scope of the order. Why, then, was there a need to write the second memo at all? And why did it take nearly 3 months to do it? The obvious answer is that Rosenstein and Mueller must have recognized that they had not complied with the regulations and were endeavoring to correct their mistake retroactively. Even the second memo failed to remedy the problem, since it also neglected to specify what federal laws might have been violated as the basis for the criminal investigation. There must first be a criminal investigation before a special counsel can be named. This did not exist. There was only a counterintelligence probe at the time of Mueller's appointment. That probe involved the gathering of information. The special counsel regulations do not allow an appointment to be used for this purpose. If it were otherwise, there would be an endless number of special counsels bootstrapped to all the various FBI counterintelligence cases that involve Russia and from which Sessions might be recused. Harvard Law professor Alan Dershowitz concluded that both of Rosenstein's orders failed to comply with the special counsel regulations. You can't investigate sins, you can only investigate federal crimes, and there is no such federal crime as collusion. In court documents, Mueller argued that his original authorization order was deliberately vague because anything specific would be confidential and might jeopardize his investigation. This is a standard excuse by prosecutors. The more plausible explanation is that the August 2nd memo was a delinquent effort by Rosenstein and Mueller to remedy their failure to comport with the regulations. They surely knew they had violated these special counsel rules, made worse by the raid of Manafort's home. So they attempted to rectify their mistake after the fact by devising a new, albeit equally defective, order. Then, under the guise of confidential, they appeared to have covered it up to conceal from the public what they had done. None of the charges against Manafort are even remotely related to any coordination between the Trump campaign and Russia during the election, nor any matters that arose or may arise directly from the investigation, as Mueller's order of appointment specifically authorizes. Nowhere is Manafort accused of crimes involving Russian officials or their government, and the special counsel has provided no evidence of it. Instead, the criminal complaint alleges wrongful conduct between 2006 and 2014. This significantly predates the presidential election. Moreover, it appears that Mueller did not uncover new evidence during the course of his investigation, but resurrected an old Justice Department investigation of Manafort in which no charges were ever brought. In federal court, lawyers for the special counsel admitted it. Judge T.S. Ellis III then accused Mueller's team of exerting unfettered power to bring down the president. I don't see what relation this indictment has with anything the special counsel is authorized to investigate. Now, I think you've already conceded appropriately that this investigation that has led to this indictment long antedated the appointment of a special prosecutor, that it doesn't have anything to do with Russia or the campaign, and he's, Manafort, indicted. And it's useful, as in many cases by prosecutors, to exert leverage on a defendant so that the defendant will turn and provide information on what is really the focus of the special prosecutor. As the judge correctly reasoned, Mueller is acting in violation of the special counsel regulations and abusing his authority. Mueller should have recused himself. The appointment of Mueller originated when fired FBI Director James Comey took presidential memos out of the FBI building, converted them to his own use, and then purposefully delivered them to a friend to leak to the media. Appearing before the Senate Intelligence Committee in June 2017, Comey admitted he engineered the leak because I thought that might prompt the appointment of a special counsel. It was a typical Comey maneuver, deviously effective. What has never been explained is how one of Comey's closest friends in Washington, Mueller, ended up being selected as the special counsel. The decision was supposedly made by Rosenstein, who has never fully explained what went on behind the scenes. But it is well known that Comey, Mueller, and Rosenstein were friends and colleagues in their various roles throughout the years with the Department of Justice. The fact that all three became involved in the investigation of Trump after the president fired one of them calls into serious question their objectivity. It is quite the cozy arrangement. As such, it is saturated with conflicts of interests. The law governing the special counsel, Title 28 of the CFR, Section 600.7, prohibits someone from serving if he has a conflict of interest. The same Code of Federal Regulations defines what constitutes a conflict. No employee shall participate in a criminal investigation or prosecution if he has a personal or political relationship with, 1. Any person substantially involved in the conduct that is the subject of the investigation or prosecution, or, 2. Any person which he knows has a specific and substantial interest that would be directly affected by the outcome of the investigation or prosecution. The regulation then explains that a personal relationship includes friendships and can be a cause for disqualification if they pose a close and substantial connection of the type normally viewed as likely to induce partiality. Several other regulations calling for recusal also govern the special counsel. In applying these rules to the Mueller probe, it is clear that Comey is substantially involved in any obstruction investigation of Trump, as reported by the Washington Post. Indeed, he appears to be the only witness to the alleged Oval Office discussion about Flynn and was involved in conversations with the president that led to his firing. Since he admits he sought a special counsel to investigate Trump, he obviously has a substantial interest in the outcome of Mueller's probe and potential prosecution. He is hardly an innocent or disinterested bystander. A conflict of interest is a situation in which an individual has competing interests or loyalties. Here it sets up a clash between the special counsel's self-interest or bias and his professional or public interest in discharging his responsibilities in a fair, objective, and impartial manner. Mueller's close friendship with the key witness raises the likelihood of prejudice or favoritism, which is anathema to the fair administration of justice. How can Americans have confidence in the results if they suspect that the special counsel may harbor bias? They cannot. The conflict inevitably discredits whatever conclusion is reached. It renders the entire investigatory exercise suspect, and it only elevates the controversy surrounding it. Mueller had no choice but to disqualify himself. The law afforded him no discretion because the recusal is mandatory in its language. It does not say may or can or might. It says the special counsel shall recuse himself in such instances. The Mueller-Comey friendship is well documented and indisputable. They have long been friends, allies, and partners. Their bond is driven by a mentor-protege relationship, which makes the likelihood of favoritism and partiality self-evident. This represents an acute conflict of interest. Even the appearance of a conflict merits recusal under the law, Title 28 of the USC Section 528. Rules of professional responsibility that govern lawyers also prohibit the appearance of conflicts. Mueller might argue he believes he is capable of being neutral, but that is not the point of the law that requires disqualification based on appearances. Mueller and Comey worked together in their respective positions at the FBI and Justice Department. In tandem, they handled several important cases. In one memorable case, they stood in solidarity, both threatening to resign over the warrantless wiretapping fiasco involving then-Attorney General John Ashcroft in 2001. But the Mueller-Comey duo is best known for badly bungling the biggest case they ever handled in a story recounted by journalist and author Carl M. Cannon, Washington bureau chief for Real Clear Politics. Letters laced with anthrax killed 5 people and infected 17 others in Washington in 2001. Mueller, Comey, and others misinterpreted the evidence and botched the case by blaming an innocent man, Stephen Hatfield, principally because drug-sniffing dogs seemed to take a liking to the suspect who had petted them. Cannon described it this way. Mueller, who micromanaged the anthrax case and fell in love with the dubious dog evidence, personally assured Ashcroft and presumably George W. Bush that in Stephen Hatfield the Bureau had its man. Comey, in turn, was asked by a skeptical Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz if Hatfield was another Richard Jewell, the security guard wrongly accused of the Atlanta Olympics bombing. Comey replied that he was absolutely certain they weren't making a mistake. Such certitude seems to be Comey's default position in his professional life. Mueller didn't exactly distinguish himself with contrition either. Their mistake ended up costing taxpayers $5.82 million in a legal settlement. But here is the interesting part that few people recall. Hatfield's successful lawsuit accused the FBI and DOJ of leaking information about him to the media in violation of the Federal Privacy Act. Sound familiar? It was very much like Comey's premeditated leak to the media of his now infamous memo reciting his alleged conversation with Trump. Perhaps old habits are hard to break. Other news organizations have chronicled Mueller's close friendship, including the Washington Post, which entitled its story Brothers in Arms, The Long Friendship Between Mueller and Comey. Perhaps most revealing was a lengthy Washingtonian story in 2013 describing in detail a deep friendship that stretches back over a decade. Mueller and Comey became close partners and close allies. So close that at one critical juncture, there was only one person in government whom Comey could confide in and trust, Bob Mueller. Against this backdrop, the inevitable conflict of interest comes into full view. If the special counsel is investigating whether the president tried to obstruct justice, the case becomes a test of he said, she said. Which man will Mueller believe? His good friend or the man who fired his good friend? How can Mueller fairly and impartially assess Comey's credibility versus Trump's? He cannot. Equally important, how can the public be assured that Mueller's decision is free of prejudice, if not animus, driven by his affection for Comey? It is reasonable to assume that Mueller was not pleased to see his good friend fired by Trump. Might the special counsel be tempted to exact retribution by conjuring criminality or other wrongdoing where none may exist? There have been innumerable calls for the special counsel to recuse himself in favor of someone who could be more objective. Prominent law professors penned columns in USA Today requesting Mueller's resignation. The editorial board of the Wall Street Journal emphasized how Mueller spent months hiding from Congress the truth about why Peter Sturzok and Lisa Page had been removed from the special counsel probe. The board urged Mueller to step aside, noting that the investigation would surely continue, though perhaps with someone who doesn't think his job includes protecting the FBI and Mr. Comey from answering questions about their role in the 2016 election. Mueller's conflict of interest is twofold. It extended beyond his fast friendship with Comey, a pivotal witness in any obstruction case. Noted George Washington University legal scholar Jonathan Turley argued that Mueller's meeting with the president created an additional disqualifying conflict. The White House has said that Mueller interviewed with Trump for the FBI position to replace Comey the day before he was made special counsel. If this conversation occurred, Trump may have explained why he fired Comey and what he was looking for in his replacement. With obstruction a focus of the investigation, that makes Mueller a possible witness in his own investigation. In other words, on a Tuesday, Mueller was interviewed by the president to become the FBI director, but on Wednesday, Mueller accepted the job to investigate the president. Surely Mueller knew he was under consideration to be named special counsel. Such important appointments don't unfold spontaneously in a day. Still, as he was sitting there talking with Trump, he never advised the president that he might investigate him. Was Mueller secretly attempting to gather evidence from Trump to incriminate him? Did they discuss the president's reasons for firing Comey, which Mueller could then use in an obstruction case against Trump? Even if Mueller is not a witness in his own case, his interaction with the president created a disqualifying conflict of interest. The appearance of duplicity was more than a sufficient basis to recuse himself from consideration as special counsel. He should never, in good conscience and under ethical rules, have accepted the position. It is hard to believe that Mueller had the audacity to accept the position as special counsel that involves, in part, the president's firing of Comey, when Mueller was directly involved in the aftermath of that firing. Ask yourself whether it is fair or ethical for a person who was passed over for a job to suddenly reverse course the next day to investigate the man who declined to give him the job. Or perhaps that was Mueller's plan all along. Maybe he had an ulterior motive. Did he devise a sub rosa plan to gather evidence from Trump that he could then use as special counsel while pretending to be interviewing for the job of FBI director? It is a distinct possibility. If so, it was deceptive and dishonest. Was Comey involved in the plan? Former federal prosecutor Sidney Powell wrote a book about corruption in the Justice Department, Licensed to Lie. She surmised that Mueller, Comey, and Rosenstein, who previously worked for Mueller, communicated extensively and hatched this plan for Mueller to be special counsel, if not prior to Comey's termination, then immediately after it. The point here is not that this is likely what happened. The point is that at every step, this investigation was steered by a very small group of people who have known each other and worked together for years. There is nothing remotely approaching independence here. Compounding the conflict is the evidence that Comey himself may have committed crimes, as outlined in previous chapters. Will Mueller be tempted to ignore the evidence against his friend and choose not to investigate and prosecute Comey? This is another flagrant conflict of interest that compelled Mueller's departure from the case. Byron York, chief political correspondent for the Washington Examiner, who argued that Mueller should resign, given his conflict of interest, pointed out the irony explained to him by one of several lawyers he consulted on Capitol Hill. The whole purpose of the special counsel is to have a prosecutor from outside the government and outside the normal chain of command, because inherent conflicts render the Justice Department incapable of handling it. So now the special counsel is a close friend, mentor-slash-mentee relationship, with the star witness, who by his own admission leaked the memos at least in part to engineer the appointment of a special counsel. Only in Washington. You can't make this stuff up. Even scrupulously honest people can be influenced in ways they do not recognize themselves. It is the human condition. This is why there are legal and ethical rules that demand recusal based on prior personal relationships. Mueller's conflict is manifest. It is not fair to Trump as the reported subject of the investigation, and it is certainly not fair to the American public. They deserve a legal process that is devoid of partiality, or at the very least, the appearance of it. By reputation, Mueller is an honest man who has served the public in high positions of government. His service and heroism in the Marine Corps during the Vietnam War is admirable. While there is little doubt about his integrity, it is fair to question his judgment. His refusal to recognize two disqualifying conflicts of interest suggests he may harbor a bias. His investigation involving the President of the United States is a serious matter and, therefore, necessitates a special counsel who is beyond reproach in both conduct and appearance. His decision to accept the position in the face of ethical rules